that God holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as unworthy of nothing else but to be cast into fire. You are 10,000 times so abominable in his eyes as the most hateful and venomous serpent in ours. There is laid in the very nature of carnal men a foundation for the torments of hell.
This quote from Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, evokes both sadness and anger as it fails spectacularly to reflect the loving heart of God and the inherent value placed upon God's creation. Perhaps no modern church dogma has been more destructive to the mission of Jesus, created more atheists, or generated more religious trauma than that of eternal conscious torment for the non-believer. This podcast's aim is to bring together experts in their fields to take the listener on a historical, philosophical, and theological journey to deconstruct this harmful doctrine. Along the way, the listener will not only be offered pathways to reconstruct a compelling perspective of final punishment, but ways to heal and move beyond the dire impact of eternal conscious torment indoctrination. Thank you for listening as you join us in our journey, the journey towards deconstructing hell. Hello, friends, and welcome to the Deconstructing Hell podcast. This podcast miniseries has been created as a companion to the book by the same title, Deconstructing Hell, Open and Relational Responses to the Doctrine of Eternal Conscious Torment, that was edited by Chad Ball and published by Sacrosage Press. The show is also brought to you in partnership with the Rethinking Faith podcast, hosted by yours truly, Josh Patterson. And today I have the privilege of being joined by the author of chapter 4 of our book, Deconstructing Hell, titled Constructing a Biblical Theology of Hell, The Case for Universal Restoration. And that author is the one and only Keith Giles. Keith, how are you, my friend?
Josh, I'm doing great, man. Happy to be here. Very excited about this podcast and having a chance to talk about this subject. It's really important to me. So this will be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm excited. And I don't know, you know, what order these will come out in, but as we were talking about a little bit before, this is the first go at the Deconstructing Hell podcast. So okay. I'm going to do my best and hopefully Chad is pleased and doesn't threaten me with eternal conscious torment.
Right.
All right. So, Keith, just maybe for starters, we'll go with a little bit of podcasting 101. Can you just introduce yourself for our listeners and maybe share a little bit about who you are and what kind of things you find yourself doing?
Yeah. Thanks. Sure. I'll do that. If you're not familiar with me, I am an author. I finished up this 7-part series of books that I wrote called the Jesus Un series. There's 7 different books dealing with some of the main things that people go through when they are going through deconstructing of their faith. So each book deals with one of those topics, and I try to go, answer all the questions that I can, provide as much history, background, and clarity as I can on these topics. And the books cover, I have a book called Jesus Undefeated, which deals with this topic we're going to talk about here, about eternal conscious torment and universal reconciliation from a historical and scriptural perspective. But I also have a book called Jesus Unexpected that deals with like the end times and, the second coming and all that. I have another book called Jesus Unforsaken that deals with like, how do we approach the cross and the atonement and things like that. So there's 7 different books that cover all those different topics. I just put out a book last year called Solo Mysterium about the need to embrace mystery. And I have a new book coming out very soon called Solo Deus, which is continuing the Sola series, looking at really just kind of asking the question about how do we approach God, and which is a big topic. So in addition to being an author, I'm also a podcaster, as you said. Like I do three different podcasts. I do a solo one called Second Cup with Keith. I do one with my friend Matthew DeStefano called Apostates Anonymous. And then he and I do another one we've been doing for the longest time with three other people. And that one's called Heretic Happy Hour. And then finally, in addition to all of that, I'm also the co-owner of Choir Publishing as of January of this year. And Matthew DeStefano and myself are the co-owners. And we've had a lot of fun kind of just learning how to become publishers and release other people's books and promote other people's books. And that's been really, really fun too.
Yeah, big congrats on that. I know I've read my fair share of Choir books, and Keith, you and I have chatted prior to this, you know, a few times on Rethinking Faith, discussing some of your Jesus Un series.
Yes.
Which is sitting behind me on the shelf. I don't think you can see it currently, but they're all seven are down over there. So.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah. And that's called, actually, I was about to use a word. I don't know if Chad's going to allow me to say bad words. So I was going to say, that's called butt kissing. But here. All right. Well, Keith, a fun question I thought that I would like to kind of ask all of the participants or authors that contributed to this volume, because so one thing that I think is really important is story. I think story is powerful.
Yeah.
And story often is how we relate to one another. And so I was just curious, why did you agree to be a part of this project? Like what made it motivated you to want to write about deconstructing hell?
Yeah. That's a good question. When Chad emailed me and first told me about the project, I think that's really what got me excited about it. I just thought it was a great idea to do one of these books that draws from a variety of different voices. And, you know, there's lots of those out there. Choir does those a lot too. And so, you know, those books are always kind of interesting and exciting to hear different perspectives on a topic. And certainly on this topic, this idea of eternal conscious torment and just different views of hell. You know, I'd already written my book on the topic, but it was, you know, so I was excited that it was going to happen. I thought it was a great idea. And I wanted to be a part of it. You know what I mean? I knew the other, some of the other voices, some of the other authors that were contributing. He gave me a list of who had been invited to that point. And some of them I recognized, some of them I didn't. And I just thought, you know what? I really need to be a part of this project. You know what I mean? It was something that I knew this book was going to be significant. I knew it was going to reach a whole lot of people and help a lot of people really, you know, find some kind of hope or peace or clarity around this topic, because I know it creates a lot of anxiety for many people that I've talked to. And I thought, well, you know what, if I can help them do that by adding my name to this or adding a chapter to this and providing, you know, a little bit more hope and a reason and, you know, just helping people think through this, then I definitely wanted to do it. So yeah, I was just excited about the idea and excited about the opportunity to be one of those voices contributing to the conversation.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing, Keith. And a brief follow-up to that has to do with, like, what was your own personal experience of hell, like, growing up, or like, yeah, how have you experienced this doctrine yourself?
Yeah. Well, so when you ask the question of what's my experience of hell, I would say, well, growing up from junior high through high school, I had to sit in the backseat of my parents' car listening to country music. But that's probably not what you mean.
That sounds like hell to me. All right.
especially country music in the 80s. I just want to say it was probably not the golden age. Anyway, on eternal conscious torment. Yes. Well, I think like a lot of people, and probably like a lot of people who contributed to this book, and probably a lot of the people listening to this. I was raised Southern Baptist, you know, and my whole life, this was the only version I'd ever heard, you know, of hell. I would say the good thing is I didn't, and maybe this is different from a lot of people, I didn't enter the faith because I heard a message that said, if you don't want to burn in hell forever, raise your hand and repeat this prayer after me. So I'm grateful for that. I know a lot of people did, that was kind of their entry point. Thankfully, that wasn't mine. As a young kid, even my parents didn't go to church when I was younger. I think I visited one time with a neighbor. So I had a single experience of ever even visiting a church in my life as a young boy, like elementary school. And but at the same time, even before, you know, my parents and I started attending a church, I just used to lay in bed at night and talk to God. And so I just was curious about who God was, and I wanted to know more about God. I can remember asking my mom one time as a little kid standing in the kitchen. I was just asking all these questions about heaven and about God. And again, my mom didn't go to church, so she wasn't able to answer my questions. And I was getting really upset about that. Like, I was like, how can you not know this? You know, you're a grown up, you're supposed to know these things. And so I just, as a young person, I was just fascinated with God, and I wanted to know more about God. And so then a little bit, you know, as I get a little bit older, probably like late elementary school age, like not junior high yet, but maybe like, what's this, fifth or sixth grade, something like that. We ended up going to a church. And what I heard from the pulpit that compelled me to want to sort of, you know, go forward and make a profession of faith was that it just seemed like for the first time that pastor up there behind the pulpit had answers to those questions that I was looking for. Because he seemed to be talking about God with some amount of, you know, authority and experience. And so I was like, okay, he's telling me I need to come forward. I'm going to do that. But anyway, you know, but once you come in the door, you know, again, I came in from this, like, I think God is great. I want to know God. And then they tell me about this Jesus person. Oh, he seems cool. And I get the flannel graph, you know, Sunday school stories about the Noah's Ark and Moses and all. Okay. Yeah, this is all cool. But at some point, you know, they slowly start introducing this idea that, well, if you're not a Christian, you're going to burn in hell forever. Well, the good news was I'm already a Christian. So, okay, I guess I'm fine. But I was really scared for my friends, my cousins, my best friends at school. And so I was a young evangelist. I can remember I was kind of a pushy jerk, actually. But because I believed it, they were telling me that, you know, if you don't become a Christian, you're going to go to hell. So I was like, I've got to tell all my friends about this. And it was pretty obnoxious. But anyway, I grew up believing that all the way through high school and college. I guess it got really, I started to really double down on that whole hell thing in college. I had a Christian band I was in. Me and some other guys were in a band. And we were performing in El Paso, Texas. We were performing at colleges, at community colleges, at high schools, and Christian events and lock-ins and youth groups and all kinds of stuff. And pretty much every concert we did, one of us had to stand up, and it was either me or my friend JJ. We would stand up and give sort of a, you know, raise your hand if you don't want to burn in hell forever message. So I preached that stuff, you know, and I fully believed it.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing. And I think, I don't know. So the part of the reason I like asking that question is just because I have found, and this is definitely stolen language, this is not my language, but I have found that when we are able to go deep enough into our own story, hopefully other people can find themselves there as well.
Oh yeah.
And I think just from sharing, you know, if you could see like multiple points during your story, you know, it made me smile because it made me think of, certain aspects or elements of myself or like experiences I had in youth group or, you know, when I was still a pastor and those kind of things. So thanks for sharing. Hopefully listeners, you too found yourself in Keith's story. Cause that's ultimately the goal here, but, So, and it's fun because it seems like you have come, kind of full circle in the sense that the chapter you wrote, is called Constructing a Biblical Theology of Hell, the Case for Universal Restoration.
Yeah.
And so I thought maybe a fun way to kind of approach this is I reread your chapter again to kind of prepare for our conversation and picked out some like fun talking points.
Yeah.
Something like that along the way that might maybe we could elaborate on or kind of just give our listeners some kind of insight into what you wrote about. And so the first one that I thought was really interesting is you kind of start off your chapter talking about hell in the Old Testament, or perhaps even the lack thereof. Mm-hmm. Hell, yeah, in the Old Testament. So what are you getting at there? Where do you see hell in the Old Testament?
Yeah, I think if I was going to write that book, it would be a very short book. Hell in the Old Testament. Well, that's like one page, and it'd be a sentence not found.
There we go. Yeah,
I think that's really significant. I mean, there were, for me, when I changed my mind about, when I transitioned away from believing and teaching in a, you know, eternal conscious torment view, there's a couple of things that helped me, you know, turn the corner and change my mind on that topic. And one of those things was the fact, I think that someone pointed out to me that, well, if you're looking for a teaching in the Bible about eternal conscious torment, you won't find anything in the Old Testament. And that just really made me stop and think. I'm like, we're talking like what is the time span between Genesis and, you know, the end of that time period into the minor prophets? We're talking, I don't know, 3,000 years, 4,000 years, something like that. So you're telling me in all this time, all these prophets, God was like, ah, darn it, I meant to mention this whole thing about eternal conscious torment to Jeremiah. Okay, I'll tell Isaiah about it. And then, oh, darn it, I forgot to say Isaiah, I forgot to tell him. You know, okay, well, I'll wait till, you know, I'll wait till Daniel. Like, what? It seems like such an important thing. Like, if God's plan has always been, hey, if you reject me, I'm going to throw you in this place where you will burn in eternal torment, but he just never mentioned that? That just didn't seem fair. Like, hey, God, you would at least give us a heads up that this is kind of your plan. So the fact that it isn't anywhere in there, like, it's, in other words, it's not taught, it's not a Jewish doctrine. It doesn't come from the major prophets or even the minor prophets. It's not found in, really, it's not found in the old Hebrew scriptures. And so I just felt like that was important to point out to Christians who might still believe it and might think, no, it's in the Bible. It's like, well, is it? Because it's not in the Old Testament scriptures. And we can at least be confident about that.
Yeah, I remember having a similar experience to you once I first started like kind of asking these kind of questions for myself as well, and having like just, I don't know, it was cool to kind of like through my studies and reading be able to trace kind of the development of the idea of eternal, yeah, conscious torment, and also like other things included, right, that kind of go hand in hand with that, like the idea of the Satan.
Yeah,
or these kind of things, angels and demons, you know, like the development in Second Temple Judaism, etc.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was kind of a big mind blower for me as well. Just the whole like, wait a minute, what? It does seem, yeah, kind of important, like you said.
Yeah. No, and all that stuff, really. Yeah. And so, like you said, Satan is another one. I mean, I don't want to derail us, but I mean, that's another topic where you see a slow progressive development over a long period of time. At least Satan you can find in the Old Testament, but what you will find when you find it is that it changes. So in the beginning, which would be probably Job, you know, chronologically, Satan is walking around in heaven with all the other angels and like, hey, it's like they're at work, you know, early in the morning around the water cooler. Hey, dude, what's up? And what have you been doing, Satan? Just walking around the earth. You know, okay. They're just having this kind of casual conversation. It's like, well, how did that happen? And then Satan is like getting his marching orders from God. God is like, okay, here's what I want you to do. And you can do this, but you can't do that. You can touch this, but you can't touch that. And okay, go ahead. Go on your assignment. I just gave you your work orders. And again, that's just really different than what we see later on, where Satan becomes the accuser, the Satan, and it becomes something much more developed by the, you know, by the time of Jesus. And but hell, see, this is the thing. During that same time period, you don't have any examples of that. You do have bad translations, English translations that in the Old Testament might translate into English the word Sheol, which is just the grave, into hell. So yeah, you can probably, depending on translations you're using, you can flip open your English translation and you might in the Old Testament find the word hell, but you just need to know it's not in the Hebrew. It's not in the original text. It's something either about Sheol, or maybe Gehenna, which was their literal place. It was outside the city walls of Jerusalem in the Valley of Gehenna, or the Valley of Hinnom as well. It's also Valley of Hinnom.
Huh, so what you're saying, Keith, and not to derail us, but is that perhaps all translation is also interpretation?
Yes, sir.
And so when we have Sheol being translated as hell, that's you know, I want to give the translators the benefit of the doubt and assume that they're not being nefarious, but it's also they're bringing their own particular theology into their work as a translator, which is what all of us do, but just helpful to know, like, it says Sheol, not hell.
That's right. Yeah. So. You have to do a lot of detective work, unfortunately, to really dig down and to study some of these things. And I've been doing that kind of thing for a long time, just trying to go back and say, okay, what does that really say?
Yeah. Good stuff, Ian. Well, if we go from, you know, and forgive me for the pace, because this, you know, we could talk about Old Testament ideas of hell or not hell for hours, but
that's right.
If we were to move then into the New Testament, one thing that you do in your chapter that I think is insanely helpful, and again, for me experientially, this was something that really helped me, was you bring in this idea of apocalyptic hyperbole.
Yes.
Hyperbole. I got it third time. All right. And one thing you do is point out that, like, perhaps this is what Jesus is doing, standing within this longer tradition. So what is this apocalyptic hyperbole, and how do you see that playing out within the pages in the New Testament?
Right. Yeah. And this is another thing. So this was one of the other things that was a big deal for me, was recognizing, because, you know, again, growing up Southern Baptist, again, I was licensed and ordained as a minister. I was preaching from the pulpit, this kind of stuff. You know, you hear this phrase all the time. No one speaks more about hell in the Bible than Jesus. And I believe that. I repeated that. I thought that was exactly right. But the problem is, when you go to the verses, if you were to say, oh yeah, Jesus talks about hell all the time. Okay, well, where? Well, let's go and look. Well, when you go and look at the places where, you know, people are saying, oh, right here, Jesus is saying something about, he might use a phrase like, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched, or the smoke of the torment rises forever and ever, or something like that. He is quoting verbatim Old Testament prophets. And when he's doing that, he's quoting them using the exact same phrases in the exact same language. Now, we just said the Old Testament prophets never said a word about eternal conscious torment, and yet they used this kind of language. They also talked about the worm doesn't die and the fire is not quenched, weeping and gnashing of teeth, and they used all those kind of phrases. That's where Jesus gets them from. He's borrowing them from those Old Testament prophets who, again, never said a word about eternal conscious torment. So what were they talking about when they were using those kinds of phrases in the Old Testament? They were using apocalyptic hyperbole. And what is that? So these were prophecies, and I do it in the chapter. I kind of break it down for you. I have many more examples in both Jesus Unexpected about the end times and Jesus Undefeated about hell in my personal books. I go into much more detail because, you know, I have more space and more time to do that. But I get enough examples in this chapter to just make the point that, you know, like, read this from the Old Testament. And this is like, you know, an Old Testament prophet prophesying against Edom. And it talks about, uses that same language, worm does not die, fire is not quenched, you know, all this kind of stuff. So, or Egypt, that kind of, you know, language is used against Egypt, or even sometimes against Jerusalem itself in the Old Testament. When prophets prophesy something against Jerusalem, they'll use those same phrases, weeping and gnashing of teeth, you know, smoke of the torment rises forever and ever, all that kind of stuff. But they're never talking about what happens to anybody after they die. In those Old Testament prophets, when they are speaking that way, they are warning the inhabitants of that, whatever city or nation that they're prophesying against. They're warning them that destruction, literal, like armies are going to show up on your front door tomorrow, burn your house down, kill you, take your children as slaves into captivity. But by what they're saying, the way they're warning them about it is to use this hyperbole, this apocalyptic hyperbole, stars falling from the sky and sun not giving its light and darkness over the face of the earth. they're just basically saying to the persons that they're talking to, they're not saying the end of the world is coming. They're saying the end of your world is coming. That's kind of what they're saying. So I just thought it was important to connect those things together, that when Jesus is using those phrases, he's not talking about where any of us are going to go after we die. Those phrases, he's doing the exact same thing that Isaiah and Jeremiah and, you know, all these other guys were doing in the Old Testament when they used the exact same phrases. What Jesus was doing was warning about the destruction of Jerusalem, which was imminent, that he says is going to happen, that some of you standing here will not taste death until these things, all of these things, he says, come to pass. And that happened in AD 70. And so as I saw that personally in my own studies, and I started reading them again now through that new lens, I was realizing, well, Jesus, that's what he's talking about. He's not talking about the eternal fate of someone's soul post-mortem. He's warning the people who are alive standing there in that moment that these kinds of things are coming to them. Again, not literally, but figuratively in the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and all that. So again, I just think it's really important for us to recognize that.
Yeah, no, that's huge. And again, like just one way that kind of played out in my own experience and journey was in reading, you know, even today, although I'm much different than Josh of, you know, like 4 or 5 years ago, NT Wright, I still enjoy his writings. And when I first read his kind of discussion on like the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus, you know, some people use that to, as you know very well, Keith, use that to describe either hell or also like the end of the world, like kind of like, we're in the rapture times kind of thing. When rather it's like, no, Jesus is very much talking about like the destruction of Jerusalem. And then guess what? It happens.
It did. Yes.
And Jesus was right. Yeah. So it's very similar to that. That's just kind of what it brought to mind for me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I do think that that's really important for, again, if for Christians who may be listening and who say, no, I believe eternal conscious torment, this is something you have to reconcile. You have to make sense of this and just be honest. Like, you know, here's the thing, like one of the Bible study principles that I was taught, you know, when I was a minister in churches, you know, and teaching and things like that, Bible studies and stuff, was that, you know, you let the Bible interpret itself. And this is one of those examples. If you have a Bible that has cross references and you're reading Jesus and he uses that language, if it's a good one, it'll cross reference back to those verses I'm talking about, where Old Testament prophets use the exact same language to prophesy against Edom or Egypt or Jerusalem or all these different other cities, actual cities with actual people, and use that same language. And so, you know, you can see it. It's if you just look at it and do the cross reference, you can see plainly that Jesus is doing the same thing, using the same language. It's not about what this thing we've invented, this place of eternal conscious torment.
Yeah, it's almost to the point. I don't know. I don't want to overstate this because I don't want to like point fingers and like make fun of people. But it seems like there's commonly this refrain that I heard growing up about like taking the Bible seriously. Uh-huh. And the reason that like Josh, you're not, you know, you think hell maybe is this thing that should be questioned is because you're not actually taking the Bible seriously. For me, it's like, no, I think I am, and that's why I'm so confused right now.
Yes,
is because I am taking the Bible seriously. I'm trying to figure this stuff out. And so I don't know. I think you, if I remember correctly, you kind of mentioned maybe like a similar experience within your chapter.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Yeah, I think the way we approach the Bible is really important, and it definitely will affect the way we understand it, the way we read it, and things like that. Like as you were talking, what I was thinking of was, like when I first wrote my book on this topic, I tried to find true believers. Like I'm trying to find people, pastors, teachers, authors, anybody that would say that they genuinely believe that eternal conscious torment is in the Bible. And I've been trying to find anybody to this very day. I've been trying to find anybody willing to debate me on this topic of eternal conscious torment. And the debate topic would be, is it in the Bible? Is it taught by this to the Bible? But in the Old or the New Testament? Because I think it's the weakest of the three views, right? There's really three views of this topic of hell. And that's the one everyone believes. That's the one I grew up believing, the only one I was ever told. but it's the one that has the weakest evidence. And I'm telling you, if anybody's listening and you're like, no, Keith, you're wrong. Eternal conscious torment is in the Bible. Would you please contact me? I would love to debate you on this. Because I can't find anybody willing to do it. And that alone makes me wonder, like, why is it? Why is it so hard to find anybody willing to go on camera or to stand in front of other people and to have a normal debate where we each have equal time and we can each make our case? If eternal conscious torment is such an ironclad, bulletproof doctrine that the Bible plainly teaches, why can't I find anybody willing to defend it? That alone makes me wonder, like, do they really believe this? I don't know if they really believe it. Maybe if nothing else, subconsciously, they know that they don't want to get into that conversation.
Hmm. Yeah.
But anyway, we'll see.
Well, there it is. Open challenge from Keith.
And throwing down the gauntlet. Come at me, bro.
All right, well, Keith, one more element that you touched on in your chapter that, again, was deeply, like, it was a part of my own experience, was you kind of hit on this idea that the ultimate revelation of who God is, or the ultimate, you know, character of God is revealed to us through the person of Jesus. And this was something that was kind of huge for me. Like, when I was first kind of deconstructing my faith and having, you know, all sorts of theological conundrums and etc., I stumbled upon this group called Jesus Collective, who, like, their whole thing is like centering Jesus and like etc. And so, like, that really kind of blew the doors open for me, especially when it comes to the teaching of eternal conscious torment, because, to quote my buddy Trip Fuller, Trip likes to say, like, well, in that case, like, God isn't even as nice as Jesus. And what's up with that? And so I'm interested how your experience of, you know, seeing God through the lens of Jesus kind of shifted your perspective in this conversation.
Oh, it's huge. It's very, very important. I mean, so, you know, again, I mentioned I wrote this 7-part series. I always recommend people to start with Jesus Unbound, because it's the book that deals with this question of how we approach the Bible, because I think it's such a foundational thing. I used to read the Bible from a flat Bible perspective. And again, because I was trained to, I was told there's, you know, and what do I mean? So the flat Bible perspective is the idea that the Bible is one book, has one author, you know, God. And every word in that one book, the Bible, which is the all, you know, the whole, all the Old Testament books, all the New Testament books, all combined, all bound together in one book, is the Bible, and it's all the Word of God, and therefore it all has equal value and weight. So anything you read in anywhere in the Bible, you know, has as much authority as anything else. And I just thought that was the way it is. I mean, again, I was taught that. Well, when I suddenly realized, as someone pointed out, I was actually reading a book, doing some research. I came across this book that pointed out that it was actually talking about the Anabaptists and how they conflicted with the Reformers. It's a great book. It's called The Reformers and Their Stepchildren by Leonard Verdun. I recommend it. It's really good. But in documenting in that book, the conflict between the Reformers and the Anabaptists, he pointed out that the fundamental difference between those two groups was that the Reformers took a flat Bible approach, you know, and they explained it the way I just did. Okay. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's the way I always taught. And then he said, what the Anabaptists took was a Jesus-centric perspective. And that because they read the Bible by prioritizing the words of Jesus, the red letters, right? Because again, it tells you in John, no one has ever seen God at any time except for the Son. And that one of the reasons the Son appeared was to show us the Father. Why would anybody need to show us the Father? We have the Old Testament. It's clear, isn't it? No, that's the point that they're trying to make in John, in the Gospel of John, that we didn't have a clear and accurate picture of God's nature and character. We needed Jesus to come and show us who the Father was, which why it is emphasized over and over and over again. You know, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father, because you needed to see Jesus to understand what God was like. And this, by the way, is all through the Gospels, all through the New Testament, this idea of prioritizing the words of Jesus and prioritizing the example of Jesus above all. And so that's what the Anabaptists did. They took a Jesus-centered perspective. And when I realized that, that there was another way to read the Bible than I had ever been told, the more I looked into that Jesus-centric way of looking at Scripture, I thought, this makes way more sense. And it also dealt with all those questions and struggles that I had and other people had come to me over the years and said, well, you know, Keith, I'm confused because in the Bible here in the Old Testament, God says this, but over here, a couple of books later, he says something that seems to contradict that. Well, how do you reconcile that? And I was like, I don't know. So this was helpful. It was like, oh, we prioritize Jesus first, right? It's that whole thing about the Mount of Transfiguration, right? The Father is standing there with Moses and Elijah. Moses stands for the law. Elijah stands for the prophets. The law and the prophets that's a shortcut. That's a code for Jewish people, how they talk about the Old Testament scriptures. It's the law and the prophets. So it's personified. The law and the prophets are personified in Moses, the law, and Elijah, the prophets. So they're standing with Jesus. Peter makes the flat Bible mistake. Oh, this is great. Let's make three tabernacles side by side to honor all three of you equally. And the Father's response is, he removes Moses, he removes Elijah, he leaves only Jesus, and he says only this, this is my son, listen to him, boom, it's over. That's the point. And over again, that is what is emphasized in the New Testament, that we have Jesus, we have the mind of Christ, and we start with Jesus, first of all. So when we do that, then yes, it makes it much, much easier for us now to read some of these scriptures through that lens and make much more sense of it. I think that this is really critical. It's really important for us to do this. And to taking a Jesus-centered perspective, I think takes a lot of confusion out of these kind of this topic, but a lot of other topics as well.
Well, Keith, I have to admit, you sure seem to have a pretty high Christology for somebody who's such a heretic and an apostate.
I know. And this is the thing too. Yeah. I'm not appealing to emotion. I'm not saying this is, I'm saying, look, go to the scriptures. This is what the scriptures are telling you. And that's what I'm trying to do in these conversations, is to point these things out. As a Christian, I'm reading the scriptures, the same scriptures, but I think I'm noticing some things that other people haven't noticed. And I think it's much more faithful to the entire Bible to recognize that, like you alluded to this, that ultimately, when it comes to these three views of hell, you're not just saying what you believe about the afterlife. You're not just saying about what you believe about where people go who reject God. You're saying something about the character and nature of God, right? And so I'm someone that says, no, God is like Jesus. Jesus showed us what the Father is like, and the Father is not wrathful, not vengeful, not angry. He is forgiving, loving, compassionate, patient, right? The prodigal son is a beautiful parable. If Jesus had only given us that, that's amazing. That's a radical, huge, transformative way of looking at God that was totally different from up to anybody in the Jewish faith up to that point. And so Jesus is emphatically telling us, this is what the Father is like. And what he's telling us is that the Father is this loving, kind, compassionate, forgiving Father, Abba. And if you take that perspective, then when you go back to these three views, then if you're saying you believe eternal conscious torment, you're actually saying that you believe that God is a torturer. God is someone who would torture at least some of his children, probably the majority of them, for eternity. No mercy. Oh, that doesn't seem like Jesus, what he presented to us. The other view, annihilation, you're saying that you believe God is a destroyer. God just destroys people that disagree with him. He just burns them up, destroys them, they cease to exist. Or you're believing, or you're saying, no, that the Father that Jesus reveals to us is loving, forgiving, compassionate. He believes in restorative justice, not redemptive and restorative justice. And so I just think it's important for us to start with Jesus. And I think if we do, and we're consistent the way we apply it, at least for me anyway, I can only speak for myself. The one that makes the most sense to me, the one that aligns closely, the most closely, what I see Jesus showing us the Father is like, is a God who is loving and forgiving, kind and compassionate and merciful.
Yeah, Keith, I love that you bring up explicitly that idea that our image of God is being called into question when we, you know, are asking these kind of questions about, you know, eternal conscious torment and the like. And part of why I think that is so important is because just from like a psychological, sociological perspective, we become what we worship.
Yes.
And I think that matters. Because right. I think maybe it's crazy, but I think how we live today matters. And so when we have a God who is willing to torture the other or make them outcast, etc., then no wonder maybe today, if you could imagine a society where there are people who find those who look different than them, believe different than them, etc., and we want to other them and scapegoat them and cast them out and push them away. Maybe it's connected, maybe it's not. But I think we become what we worship, and that really, really, really matters.
No, you're right, Josh. I totally agree with you, man. I totally agree. In fact, you know, if you go back again, I love studying church history. And when you go back and study church history, especially post-Constantine, when you see the rise of the Roman Catholic Church and the church being wedded with the state, the church now having the power of the sword to enforce its doctrinal beliefs to the point of death and torture. Sadly, that is, you're right. You see exactly what you just said. You see Christians who, because they believe that God's intention is as a loving God, loving Father, he is going to torture people for eternity. He is going to destroy people. Well, then what's a big deal if all I do is destroy their flesh for a temporary time here? God's going to do it for eternity beyond this. And they even justified some of the, you know, the Inquisition and some of the torture that they did to say, well, see, it's good because, you know, if we can apply some torture to them now to their temporary bodies, that they recant these heretical beliefs, then we'll save their eternal soul on the other side. And, you know, it gives you permission to justify your violence. And like you said, you're othering of people that don't think like you and believe like you. It's, I mean, historically, that kind of believing, it does exactly what you said, right? We become like what we think God is like. And we use that to justify all kinds of evils. And historically we have, sadly.
Yeah, big time. And I mean, we see it play out in like such a wide variety of ways. You know, like slavery, for example, comes to mind, or the oppression of women.
Yes.
Or currently, you know, the current, in my estimation, at least, like one of the biggest, you know, scapegoats within like a lot of Christian circles today are members of the LGBTQ plus community.
Yes, that's right.
So like, and our theology matters because it provides the kind of basis for the justification of such kind of beliefs and behaviors. And if our God looks like us doing those things, then of course it makes sense.
That's right. No, you're exactly so, right.
All right. Well, Keith, I wanted to kind of, try to, so keep within the spirit of the book, because there's a variety of perspectives within in the book, right?
Yes.
And the thing that kind of unites everybody, I guess, is maybe two things. One, Jesus, like we've talked about. And two, we all kind of think like, hey, eternal conscious torment is kind of not the greatest. Maybe we should ditch that.
Maybe we should get rid of that.
Look at some other options. But so in keeping, you know, in spirit with that, I want to try to play devil's advocate with two quick questions.
Sure.
And I will show my hand and say, so listeners know, and also you probably already know this about me, but like I fall within the larger umbrella of like universal restoration. I nuance it like way a lot, like most people do. But
yeah.
So two questions. I'll hit this. I'm going to flip how I'm going to ask them because we're kind of just hitting on this. But one thing I'd want to ask you about is I'd want to ask you, like, do you believe that scripture is multivocal? It's not, you know, it doesn't speak with one voice. Rather, there are different perspectives within scripture kind of, you know, wrestling with one another. That's my guess. Yes. Is probably yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. That's a great point. I would definitely say yes. That in other words, the Bible is not of one mind. On almost anything. And on the Jewish tradition, right, going back to the Old Testament scriptures, that's why there's this joke that when you get three rabbis in the room, you have four opinions, because they just value the what if, or here's another idea, another perspective. And so, you know, it's only modern day Christians who insist that every book, that there's no contradiction in the Bible and all, everything aligns perfectly. We've invented this version of infallibility and inerrancy. Jewish people with their own scriptures are the opposite. They love the fact that Isaiah challenges something that Moses said, or that Amos challenges something that Isaiah said, or that David challenges something, you know, that Jeremiah said, that they regularly have different opinions and views about who God is and what God is like and what's going on. So that's number one. Yes, it's multivocal. It's not univocal. And it's also progressive. So in other words, you can kind of trace, again, if you went historically, and this is hard to do sometimes because our Bibles aren't arranged chronologically, but if you can figure out first the datings, a ballpark idea of about when certain things were written, you can trace the development of some ideas. Like we just mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, Satan, right? They did not start off believing that Satan was the absolute pure evil and his goal was to just, you know, foil God's plan at every turn. No, in the beginning, they thought he was on God's team. He was part of the payroll, and he worked. You know, he worked for God's organization, and he did the assignments that God gave him. Go there, do this. Okay, great. Yes, sir. And went and did it. So that was over time that developed, and you can find that with a lot of different views in the Bible. So you're right. It's not a univocal book. There are many different voices, and so it allows us, I think the good thing about that is that what it should do is allow us to, what I like to say is, get over our need to be right about everything, like to let go of certainty, because if the goal is not to be certain, because if you're holy, if you have a holy book, if you have a book of scripture that is a bunch of different voices and a bunch of different books with a bunch of different perspectives, the one thing you don't have is certainty. You've got confusion a little bit, and you've got, well, now I guess I need to start thinking about this for myself. What do I think makes sense, right? Where can I take the conversation? And so I think actually that's another way we should approach the scriptures, as an ongoing dialogue and conversation between God and humanity and humanity and God. And so I don't think there is one thing said in the scriptures. I think there's several things that are said, different ideas, and we have to wrestle out for ourselves which ones we think make the most sense.
Yeah, that was super well said, Keith. And I, you know, for me, when I think about it, that actually makes the Bible more exciting to me, because I see it as like an invitation into an ongoing conversation. And here's some really cool, I don't want to say they're like just ideas, but maybe here's like our experience of the divine or Yahweh, et cetera, mm-hmm. and how we're trying to make sense of our current experience in light of what we think about God, et cetera. And now we're, you know, putting them together and putting them in conversation and trying to figure this out together. And then people like you and me, who are very much removed from the text, but still invited in to participate within that conversation. Yes. And I think that's deeply meaningful. And part why I wanted to bring up the multivocality was just kind of to, you know, try to be fair and point out that I think we can find, even though we might think they're weaker or not as great, arguments for eternal conscious torment, you know, annihilation and ultimate reconciliation within the pages of scripture.
Yes.
And I think then what we do is, you know, we find the one that one of them ends up making the most sense for a variety of reasons, and then we kind of subjugate the other text to that. Yes. But I think everybody does that. Like, I don't think it's unique to anybody. I think if you believe in eternal conscious torment, dear listener, you're doing the same thing as Keith and I do when we're like, well, we think maybe this ultimate reconciliation bit is better. And I'll say this, and then I'll let you respond, because I'm interested, like, genuinely. If I'm honest with myself, and I hate admitting this, if I'm honest with myself, I think annihilation or conditional immortality is perhaps the strongest biblical argument I can make. However, as an aspiring mystic, in scare quotes, my experience of the divine does not allow me to believe that. Yeah. And so I take in a different form of knowing, which I guess solo Mysterium probably brings that kind of into the conversation. And that kind of is what ultimately moves me into this like more ultimate reconciliation kind of place. So I don't know. I just thought it was interesting to bring up.
No, it's very interesting actually. And thank you for being that honest and vulnerable. And that's the truth. So I try to do that in my book, Jesus Undefeated, when I approach this topic, because I take all three views. I take all three of views and I give scriptural support for eternal conscious torment. And then I sort of debunk it. Like, or why I think, well, these are the verses that seem to say it, but do they really say it? And then I take annihilation, same thing. And these are the verses that people are annihilationists, these are the verses they'll point to. And then I try to take them one at a time and deal with those. And then we looked at universal reconciliation. We did the same thing. And so, but I said exactly what you said in the book, and I used different words, obviously, but I essentially though said the same thing. I said, look, from the earliest days of church history, we go back as far as we can find church fathers that believed all three of those things. In other words, there's groups of them that believed eternal conscious torment, there's some of them that believed annihilation, and there's some of them that believed universal reconciliation. So from the beginning of Christianity, those three views have always existed. Why? Because they're all biblical, meaning all three camps, all three views are pulling from the same Bible to say, I got 20 verses right here that says that I'm right about eternal conscious torment. And annihilationists go, no, I got 20 more too. And look at mine, universal reconciliation. Well, I got a bunch too. So again, to be fair, each of those views, no matter which of those three views you happen to hold, you do so because you're convinced the scriptures support that view. Of course you do, but so do the rest of us. And so I point out in the book that, you know, at the end of the day, what we're all doing, no matter which of those three views we're holding, we're all doing the same thing. We are aware of those other verses from those two other views that might contradict what we believe. But all of us, no matter what we believe, we are prioritizing the verses that we believe support what we think is true, right? And we are we're finding ways to have a dialogue around how we would understand those other verses in a different way. And that is true, again, of all three views. And we're all doing it, all of us. It's not... What I just said isn't like, oh, yeah, that's what those universalists do. Yeah, and so the annihilationists, and so the people that believe eternal conscious torment. We're all doing it. And again, and this is, again, part of the problem because of going back to the scriptures aren't univocal, right? The Bible says different things, depending who's talking, who's writing, who their audience is, what they're trying to emphasize or communicate. And again, this is why it puts it back in our lap where we have to decide. And so what I have done is I've just decided for me, it's more consistent, I think, at least for where I'm at now, that these scriptures, by the way, I found like 76 verses in the scriptures that affirm this idea that God's intention is to renew and restore everyone, all humanity, all creation. That we're all quote unquote saved. But again, I do so because I think that's more consistent with a Jesus-centered idea of what God is like. But it's good to point out, and I think especially for this podcast series and going forward, you're going to be interviewing different people from different perspectives. And so people are going to hear from people that are going to think I'm crazy and I'm wrong, and that's okay. You know, again, what we can agree on, at least between annihilationists and universal reconciliation believers, is that we will agree on is eternal conscious torment should be mothballed. We should just get rid of that. There should only be two views. We can deal with those two, as long as we don't start painting God again as this someone who's worse than Hitler, right? This torturer, cosmic torturer, who's going to torture children, his children for eternity.
Yeah, no, Keith, I love it. I guess so. Final question. I'll play one more devil's advocate, and this time I won't qualify it as much. Although I'll give you a wink, so you know that I'm trying to, you know. I'm not agreeing with what I'm saying. So here it is. So Keith, as somebody who believes in universal restoration or ultimate reconciliation, are you saying that God is not just? Because even somebody like Hitler that you just brought up, they just get a poof pop up into heaven whenever they die. Is that what you're saying? Wink.
Yes. No, no, but it's a very valid question. I mean, I've heard this many, many times. So, no, I'm not saying God isn't just. I do believe God is a God of justice. But again, we've only been sold one brand of justice, which is this retributive justice, where you did something bad, so God therefore must punish you. And that's primarily the way God responds. Again, in Jesus Undefeated, I go into much more, a lot of detail about this, going through the, there's the prevailing example in Scripture of the way God responds to disobedience is restoration. It's not destruction, and it's not retribution. It's restorative. And so, yes, I believe God is a God of justice, and I think God's justice will be accomplished, but that his justice can be accomplished without destroying us or killing us or torturing us or forever banishing us from his presence. I understand that a lot of us personally, you know, we think about someone like Hitler. We might even just think about, something like, you know, like a pedophile or someone that rapes somebody, or there's something really horrible, murders somebody. And we would say, you know, that just doesn't seem right that God would just forgive them. And I think what we need to recognize is that all of us, universal reconciliation doesn't teach that anybody will escape, quote unquote, the fire, right? All three views use this metaphor of fire. It's a metaphor, first of all. It's not actual fire. It's a metaphor. But that fire metaphor throughout Scripture is cleansing. That's why it's in one place. It's compared in Malachi. It's the refiner's fire and the launderer's soap, right? Soap doesn't kill anybody. Soap doesn't torture anybody. So what does it do? It cleanses and it purifies and it heals and it restores. And so everyone will pass through the fire, according to the universal reconciliation view. Everyone, the righteous and the unrighteous, right? Paul says that. He uses that example that, you know, we'll all pass through the fire. Some of us, that fire will burn up all the things that aren't of God, but there's gold and silver and precious stones. They'll be revealed and give glory to God. But he says, even if someone passes through the fire and it all burns up, there's nothing, nothing of Christ in you, nothing good in you. He says, and yet they'll be saved as those who pass through the fire. So everyone is going to pass through whatever this phase is, this fire phase, which essentially is meant and intended to renew us and restore us and reveal Christ in us. And so if Hitler goes through that and becomes the kind of a person who deeply regrets what he did and is ashamed of what he did and receives healing and restoration, you know, for that awful thing that he did. And if the rapist does that and the murderer does that and the pedophile does that, if everyone, including you and me, we also then would go through that too, for the ways we have failed and fallen short. All of us enter heaven then at the same time as people who have gone through that cleansing and restoration, being brought back to this level of, I want to say, like an original goodness, so that we would, the part of us right now that feels like, I'm not happy with that. I'm not happy with that idea of that horrible person showing up and receiving God's mercy in heaven. But here's the thing, the part of you that isn't comfortable with that right now is the part of you that's going to be transformed and restored, so that you'll be thrilled. You'll rejoice. You'll go and give that person a hug with tears. You'll be like, it's so beautiful, isn't it? Because you've received the same beautiful mercy that I just received. And we're all going to celebrate that, receiving that mercy. And so, yeah, that's how I would respond to it. I think God's justice is absolutely real, but I think the intention of it is restoration. And he says that, he promises the restoration of all things.
Yeah, no, I love it. It was solid, solid answer to that question, Keith. And it just reminds me too of this, you know, I'll throw out one other metaphor and then we'll wrap things up. Because I feel like I'm being unfair. I'm giving my hand away too much and I still have other authors to interview. There's an author that I like named Marjorie Suhaki. She's like a process relational thinker. And in her one book, forgive me, I'm going to look it up real quick just so I don't get it wrong. Marjorie Suhaki. She has a really beautiful book on, essentially it's about like a Christian affirmation of religious pluralism. It's called Divinity and Diversity, a Christian Affirmation of Religious Pluralism. Perfect. Marjorie Suhaki. And in that, she talks about, and kind of, again, it's more so a, she'll call it speculation, if you will, but she kind of tries to give an image of what this like purifying fire might be like. Mm-hmm. And how she talks about it is through the language of like restoration and reconciliation. And so she kind of imagines like, okay, Marjorie, I now, you know, I've passed away and enter into whatever heaven or whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And I am now faced with all of the ways that I have caused harm to others or to creation or to God, etc., and have to face all of these things, recognize those things, but then ultimately am forgiven and restored. And so she offers this picture of a beautiful like restoration of relationship, right? Because as a process thinker, she kind of holds to this idea that all things are kind of interrelated and that all things like exist within relationship. And yes. So like I am only fully Josh in as much as I recognize that even this conversation that I've had with you has now made me who I am, and any, you mm-hmm. know, harm that I might do to Keith, I need forgiveness for, et cetera. Yeah. And so yeah. Kind of like go through that process and then ultimately restores, maybe it's our awareness to this like more beautiful reality that all things are deeply interconnected and related.
Yeah.
And so I just think that's still a process of refining. It's still fire. It's still painful. Like I'm like, oh man, I have to look at all the ways that I was like a really shitty husband. Like that's not like, that's a lot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So. No, that's exactly right. I mean, I go to the verse in Hebrews, Hebrews 12, which I think describes what we're talking about. It says that God disciplines his children. And it says, in fact, it says, it qualifies and says, if you don't undergo discipline, you're not a true child. But then it says, but we all go through it. So all of us are the children of God because we all go through this discipline, whatever you, however you want to, again, that's another metaphor, but it's telling us why God does this, right? It says God disciplines us, all of us, for our good, so we can share in the holiness of God. That's the reason why. God doesn't discipline us just for the sake of causing pain to us, hurting us, torturing us. God doesn't do this discipline process because he just wants to get rid of us, you know, burn us up and, you know, delete us from the universe. No, it says that God disciplines his children, all of us, because God's desire is for our good, and it's so that we can share in the holiness of God. And then it ends by saying that this process yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. And I believe whatever this process is, this fire, whatever you want to, our metaphor you want to use, that we go through, yes, parts of it will be uncomfortable. It even says that again in Hebrews 12, that no one enjoys discipline while it's happening. It's not pleasant, right? It's uncomfortable when it's happening. But when it's over, we look back on it and we say, this was better. It was good. It was for my good. And so whatever God is going to do, it will be for our good, for everyone's good. And in the ultimate goal of that, whatever that process is for God to allow Christ to be revealed in all of us.
I love it. I love it. Well, actually, I'll say I'm impartial to what you're describing because I'm trying to remain as a neutral host of this mini-series thing. Maybe it's like that.
Yeah.
All right, Keith. Well, to wrap up, I want to ask you like maybe a question that falls more on like the pastoral side of things.
Yeah.
So what advice would you give to somebody who maybe is listening right now and they are wrestling through this question of not just eternal conscious torment, but the doctrine of hell as a whole? They're, you know, deconstructing hell to use the title of the book. What advice might you offer somebody like that?
I would say, you should send an email to Joshua Patterson and ask him. No, I'm just kidding. no, I mean, so yeah, if somebody is wrestling through this, I mean, it's going to sound cliche, like, you know, buy the book. But I mean, really, I think this book would be really helpful for someone who is wrestling through these things, because you're going to hear different perspectives on this topic. You're going to hear the other side. If you have, like I and Josh, you grew up being taught eternal conscious torment, you're going to hear a bunch of voices giving you a totally different perspective than anyone has ever told you from the pulpit. So I think this book is a great place to start. I'm going to pitch my book too. I think Jesus Undefeated. My book deals with this as well. And I look at all three of you, so I try to cover all of them. But I would even say too, it would be okay for you to reach out to me or, you know, I can't speak for the other authors in the book, but most of the ones that I know anyway are pretty, accessible. Here's the thing. I'm always interested. If someone sends me a question, sends me a private message or contacts me on social media, and they have a genuine question about they're struggling with it because they're trying to get answers to this for themselves. I'm always happy to take time to respond to people like that. I don't have a lot of time anymore for people that want to ask me these things because they want to debate me or argue with me. But if someone is genuinely curious and wrestling through something, struggling with something, I'm happy to help people with things like that. So yeah, I think if you are in that boat, or just keep listening to this podcast, because again, you're going to hear a lot of people answer a lot of questions and respond to a lot of things that are probably going to come up for you as you are deconstructing hell.
Yeah. Well, Keith, thank you so much for your time, for your contribution to this book, but also your contribution to the world. As you know, as you've mentioned, you've written plenty of other books and have done plenty of podcasting, etc. And listeners, again, the book is called Deconstructing Hell. You can pretty much find it where books are sold. And yeah, thanks for hanging out with us today. Hopefully you found this episode helpful. And if you have any questions, like Keith said, I mean, Keith already offered, you can reach out to him and hit me up if you want to. Keith might be more fun to talk to, but no. I'll be happy to do my best to answer any questions, or maybe give responses rather than answers. And we can go from there. But yeah, in the meantime, again, thank you so much for hanging out, Keith, and listeners, thanks for being a part of this. And Chad, shout out to you for, you know, coming up with this book idea and putting in the difficult work of wrangling a bunch of crazy individuals like myself, and editing and etc. So yeah, and listeners, one way I like to end Rethinking Faith is by telling people, go in peace. So listeners, go in peace. Yeah.